Hello, I'm Martin Kessler. You're listening to FlixWise Canada. On this episode, I'm joined by filmmaker and illustrator Patrick Horvath. Hi, Patrick. How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. It's a pleasure to be on your program, my man.
I'm glad this finally worked out. I don't usually plug my writing on the show, but for anyone who has read some of my articles, they've seen some of your illustrations because you've done artwork for things I've written for The Pink Smoke in the past.
I mean, I love them because, one, it's usually for films that I'm totally unaware of and are excellent. And then, two, it's always awesome source material to work from. They're just fun. They're fun pieces to put together.
I'm glad. I would feel guilty if it was miserable.
No, not at all. They're actually very, they're almost always very moody in like the best sort of ways.
And the film we're going to be talking about today is Wait Until Dark. The basic story revolves around three criminals trying to find a doll with drugs hidden inside of it somewhere in an apartment owned by a blind woman who's played by Audrey Hepburn. And it's been a little while since I saw the film. I think the last time I watched it may have been 10 years ago on a laptop on a train, so I didn't really remember the film that well. But when you suggested it as a topic, I was like, oh yeah, that movie. And I'm glad I was able to revisit it because it's really, really good.
Yeah, it is.
So, Patrick, how were you first introduced to the film?
It honestly, I watched it when, so I did film school and when I was at University of Iowa. And then afterwards, I ended up in Chicago for like several years working at a video store. And for one reason or another, whatever plans I'd had out of college had kind of fallen through. And I just ended up in this weird malaise of just like in this video store. And it was sort of like a film school part two where I could basically just watch whatever. And so I would just start filling in a lot of gaps in my film watching. And this was just one of those like, oh, this looks pretty good. I'll watch it. And it was just like, it floored me. Because I was so unprepared for how well it's executed. And it has always stuck with me as a film that I feel like has just not really been talked about that much. And is something that whenever I get the chance to talk about, I love doing it. Which is when you asked me if I'd be interested in doing something, I was sort of thinking, I was like, oh yeah, like Wait Until Dark. Like let's get down. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, no, that's a really good pick. What happened while I was watching it, I was like, oh, this reminds me a lot of Dial M for Murder, yeah. Which is my favorite Hitchcock film. I was like, oh, like very similar sort of structure, the kind of idea of there's some criminals and they come up with something they think is the perfect crime and it turns out to not be at all. And that kind of confined space and mm-hmm. a lot of things like that. And of course, after, you know, I go and look and, oh, right, Friedrich Knott also wrote Dial M for Murder. It's the same.
So similar.
Playwright.
Yeah.
They're both. Yeah. So like they are very similar. That kind of came through. And it almost feels like Dial M for Murder with like a little bit of a, I don't want to say grimy, but it has this bit of edge to it that I found kind of surprising for the period. Like it kind of comes at a strange transitional time, I thought.
100%. I completely agree with that. And that's part of the reason why it stuck with me so well. Mm-hmm. You know, Friedrich Knott is Dial M for Murder in my head, right?
Yes.
Like he's got, like he's so good at really tight constructions and really effective mechanics and a thriller plot twist, right?
Right.
And it's on display in spades with Wait Until Dark. But the thing of it is that it's totally got that weird edge to it. And I mean, we can get into this in a little bit further down the road when we talk about Alan Arkin's part in all of it. But he's, to me, part of the central, you know, nexus of, like, that weird edge.
I think so. Like, he's sort of this sadistic beatnik kind of a character. It's very unusual, but...
Yes. He's strangely subversive, yeah.
Like, Alan Arkin, I almost... first of all, I didn't remember that it was Alan Arkin in the film when I went back to revisit it. But then, like, you know, when his name pops up in the opening credits, I was like, oh, that, you know, the... A part of me always kind of associates him now with the grandpa from Little Miss Sunshine and stuff like that, and more comic roles. So to see him play this character who, like, there is a certain amount of humor in what he's doing, but he's also this really mean, kind of grimy guy. And I think that caught me off guard a little bit.
Oh, yeah. He was always, I mean, like, to me, I think he came on my radar as just a film viewer when I saw, Edward Scissorhands. And then... when you start, you know, rewinding his filmography and then you're like, oh, and for whatever reason, he'd always, in my mind, was like, oh, yeah, he's like Sheldon the dentist from The In-Laws.
Right.
And that's just, he's sort of this affable, you know, he's got this real kind of depressed demeanor about him in this kind of affable way.
He's a lovable grump, usually. That's the kind of character yes. he most yeah. often plays, yeah.
And so, again, like, when I see him, and when I saw him for the first time in Wait Until Dark, it totally floored me. And so it's got all these things that are working for it, but it's also, you know, like you'd mentioned, it's based on a play written by Frederick Knott. And so it's a bottle film, essentially.
Yes.
And for my money, like, I'm always interested in whether or not you can pull off a good bottle film. It's hard to get the recipe right.
You can tell if a filmmaker has, like, a really good formalist background. And I think Terrence Young does. He's sort of thought of more as a journeyman type filmmaker, but he has that total control over yeah. every scene, and you really get engrossed into how does it maintain suspense over the course of this prolonged scene. Like, I kind of love movies where you can feel like after, oh, I could probably count the scenes on just my fingers, and this has that, and also Dial In for Murder, like
yeah.
these really prolonged kind of sequences, and I think that's part of what makes films like this really interesting. And it's still popular even today. You see a lot of thrillers kind of built around this idea of mostly being set in one location.
Sure. And it's very much, I mean, it's also like, that's like the Blumhouse production model.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like these are the movies that I've made. Like, these are movies right. that are like single or limited location horror thrillers that are, or supernatural or whatever, that it's largely budgetary. And what's funny is that many times, because it's budgetary, you don't have the time to really get into the mechanics that are, it's, you got to fight to do the yeah. filmmaking when you make movies that way. Like, many times your AD's yelling at you that whatever close up, like, special shot you're shooting isn't really necessary. And you got to sit and argue why it is.
Right.
Because you watch, like, a really good example is Dial In for Murder, because it's largely that apartment. And it's like, there's so many specials that are done for, I mean, Hitchcock's, one of his best moves is just showing objects. Like, I always felt like Hitchcock and like David Lynch are both really good at shooting objects. And they do it. It's like visual storytelling. It's visual communication. And they're super good at it. And the thing is that you got to do time. That's lighting. And that's setting it up, and that's making sure it's going to cut. And it's tough to do all that stuff, which is why, again, like, it's easy to get lazy with a bottle film. I guess is why I'm always impressed with good ones.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and also, like you mentioned, it's really hard to sustain suspense.
One film I thought of that came out recently that is similar in a lot of ways was Parasite.
Oh, sure.
You know, that huge middle section where it's not exactly a thriller for the entire movie, but there's that middle, or I guess towards the second half of the film, that large kind of thriller section where they're hiding in the house. And I guess even you could say the setup of Parasite with them pretending to be somebody else and kind of gaming the people who live in the home to get inside and get a foothold in this home is sort of similar to this. Like, Wait Until Dark, I kind of liked the way these three criminals, they have disguises and they're all playing on different angles to work this con of getting into her home.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of also where the menace comes from is,
oh yeah,
especially Mike Tallman, like, he's pretending yeah. to be her husband Sam's friend, and just right. something about the, oh, like, look, there's a photo of me on the wall, ha ha ha, because, you know, her husband's a photographer, and like,
oh,
that
yeah.
like kind of makes my skin crawl, the way he sort of pretends to be a friend of her husband and how he positions himself as being friendly and trustworthy in this really insidious yeah. way. It's very creepy.
And this is touching on two things that I love about it as well. Like, beyond the, just the bottle film setting, it's, well, the first thing that you'd mentioned was the idea of just these alternate personas they're taking on.
Mm-hmm.
And that in and of itself is like it's a trope in films that I love, whenever you're just calling attention to the fact that these are, they're very literally playing these different roles within the film, but they are quite actually just actors pretending to be these people on screen. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And I love it anytime that that's brought to the forefront with a film. And it's funny too, because, like, contextually, this movie is like, it came out in 67, and right the year before it, Persona came
right.
out. And Persona is like one of my all-time favorite films that does that move of quite literally, like, switching the roles of the people. And the actors are now just, like, you know, they're taking on these different personas.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever you can have it play into, like, even a less obvious way, it's just such a fun, I don't know. There's something I'm probably in the minority, maybe, maybe not, but I like a fair amount of artifice, like in my movies,
yes,
which is again, partially maybe why I'm so into Italian horror stuff as well. Like I'm super forgiving about anything that's, you know, maybe odd or shows the seams or whatever.
I mean, this does have a little bit of a giallo vibe to it.
Oh, it definitely does. Especially with Richard Crenna's straight razor, weapon of choice or whatever.
All the strange weapons and...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, not to get too ahead of myself, the other point that was really interesting that you touched on was the idea of essentially the malevolence of taking advantage of this woman who's blind in her apartment. And it's funny because, like, the movie's super measured, right?
Yes.
And you get into it, and the first people you see are the criminals. The first people you're introduced to are the bad guys, which is totally an interesting move. And in doing so, like, it's just setting up the chess pieces and telling you how they play. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you see them, and then the two guys who are sort of trying to figure out where Rote's coming from, and Alan Arkin's Rote sort of comes in. And
they have that little gladiator moment with the stool and the tripod.
so bizarre. But it's the idea that, like, they're all sort of caught off guard.
Yeah.
And I think that that's just such a wonderful thing. And then all of a sudden in comes Audrey Hepburn and Susie. And then you have the introduction of the woman who'd been killed earlier hanging in the closet, which she can't see, but she's right by. And then that malevolence is just immediate. It's funny because that's kind of become a trope in and of itself of the horror film with the blind person who can't see the whatever. Like, I immediately thought of, have you seen See No Evil with Mia Farrow?
Yes.
Yeah. Which is essentially like this, except just drawn out. Like, what if it was just all dead people and she just had to discover them? But that's sort of the, I don't know, Jennifer 8 is another.
I was going to bring up Jennifer 8, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's great stuff. It works really well because it's very effective.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, I think that, and I guess the fact that it's Audrey Hepburn, you know what I mean?
I know, like, terrorizing Audrey Hepburn, who you associate with Roman Holiday and all these films, it just makes it extra mean-spirited. And I think the fact that it goes kind of beyond just trying to get the drugs, there's this extra little nastiness to him. She has that line where she says,
"It's different with Mr. Rote, isn't it? I think it's more than the dog with him. That he wants to do evil things."
Yeah.
They're not totally explicit, but towards the end, it kind of insinuates that he has other nasty motivations, evil motivations. And it just puts this film in like a really kind of like uncomfortable territory that feels a little bit surprising for a Hollywood released film from 1967. You know, it feels in some ways like a little bit more jagged than what I would expect from that time period.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Michael Powell's Peeping Tom from 60 was like totally unnerving. And I just don't think a lot of people were ready for it at all when it came out. I mean, it even places like gnarly now for the most part. And I feel like a lot of these sort of edgier films, it felt like were sort of tapping into that thing.
Yeah.
Which I think went badly for Peeping Tom financially.
Well, it almost feels like, I think Psycho came out that same year. It also came out 1960. And it's like, okay, like,
yeah,
you got Psycho, here's Peeping Tom. And it's like even more extreme. And I guess that was too much for some audiences. I don't know.
It's
a really great film.
But it really is. And it's a shame that it was so reviled at the time. But it's, again, though, it did feel like there were elements of that that were sort of tapped into from films that sort of followed up that were smaller for sure. I mean, like Seconds also came out, I think 66 or something like that. And a film like Seconds is just felt very raw.
Yeah.
And interesting and strange. And I feel like, and Blow Up came out around 66 too. There was something about that it kind of struck me that Alan Arkin's Rote is just sort of, that's the mechanism that kind of taps into that.
Right. I think that's part of the reason why this feels a little bit above some of its contemporary thrillers. It kind of goes a little bit further. And, you know, you see thrillers where it's just about the money or just about the diamonds. And I think to kind of put in these darker motivations, it sort of takes it into some surprising territory that I think films a little bit later you see explore more of. And I don't know, like some of that relationship between the cruelty of captor and victims, like I think of like Last House on the Left and stuff like that, that came just a couple of years later. And to me, this felt like sort of right on that fault line of like the classic Hollywood still kind of around, the way it looks and all that.
With its own song
right.
from Harry Mancini.
Yes.
Void Until Dark, and it's very jazzy.
Although, like, I really love that discordant soundtrack that he puts through a lot of it. That
Mancini's score throughout is wonderfully subtle and unhinged for the most part, with some really terrific spikes throughout.
I feel like that kind of score, it's designed to give you a stomachache, but like in a good way, you know?
Yeah. It reminds me in sort of like an inspirational way of where the score for Altman's Images ended up going.
I could see that, yeah.
Where it's like a very discordant. It feels sort of metallic in a weird way.
It's working to make you never feel easy. And I think that's kind of important when, okay, we're going to have a lot of the film set in one location and a lot of these sort of wide masters, and you don't want the audience to just get too settled, I think is part of it.
I mean, it does one of the best jobs of a score, which is set the psychological space. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it works in tandem with the character dynamics so well and just the production design of it. Again, like I said, these bottle films are so hard to do well that it kind of, you know, it needs all this stuff working in concert. I mean, the movie to me, the three acts are sort of set up in the space as like the ordered apartment, which immediately is sort of off kilter with the dead body in it.
Yeah.
But then there's the messy apartment while they're tearing it apart looking for the doll, and they're doing their ruse, and everybody thinks that it's all, you know, they're basically winning one over on the blind lady. And then it turns into her bashing out all the light bulbs in this very aggressive and empowering sort of move on her part, to essentially like bring everything down to a level playing field.
Yeah.
And it feels very manic and fitting. It also reminded me a lot of Green Room.
Yeah, that also had that confined, tense feeling to it.
Totally. It was very, I mean, it's very much like it's, you know, you're entered into a location, things go wild, and then it just gets like annihilated. Yeah. Like, it's just like very much destroyed.
There's like a little bit of a Chekhov's gun feeling when you see, you know, sometimes in films, like a nice apartment or a vase, and it's like, oh, you want to see that smashed by the end of the movie sometimes. There's a little bit of that. And I love how many little setups and payoffs there are throughout. Like even the fridge early on comes back. You sort of get to understand the geography of the apartment.
Oh, yeah. They milk all that stuff is like so. It's, again, it's just so set up well and, you know, by visual communication that knows what it's doing. And you don't see stuff that doesn't play. Like, that ashtray plays so much. And, like, that fridge is huge. Like, who would have thought that a fridge would be, like, you know, one of the biggest, like, working props.
I love the sound coming out of it. Like, it just sounds like this dominant
and she
force.
Knows. Yeah. Or, like, the squeaking shoes or, like, all that stuff. It's so cool.
Yeah. The little girl character, Gloria, when she first trashes Susie's place, that was another thing too for me, is seeing a portrayal of a kid not being totally wholesome in the Hollywood film.
Yeah.
I always kind of love that when you get a film that shows kids in a very unvarnished way, because, you know, kids can be mean-spirited too. That scene where she doesn't want to close the fridge door.
Did you close the door?
Yes.
But I didn't hear it shut.
Okay, so it's open.
Please shut the door.
Close it yourself. You're nearer.
Gloria, close the door.
No!
Gloria!
No, I won't!
Listen, you little monster, I won't put up with this one more minute. What's that?
She's being such a shit to Susie, you know. I kind of love that. Like, especially, you know, there's so many films where the kids just come across like overly wholesome, and it's not that she's bad. Like, ultimately, Gloria's pretty helpful, but
it's the best move because it's essentially creating this ally.
Yes,
where once there was this enemy.
Yeah,
and it's, I mean, she's introduced as like her obviously not liking Gloria. Or her even assuming that Gloria is just hiding in the apartment when it's actually the dudes.
Yeah.
The first time that she walks in. And she's like, Gloria, I know you're there. And then you see Gloria and you're like, oh, I get it. This kid's like a brat sometimes.
That's way more interesting than if Gloria was just the friendly, helpful kid coming to check in on the blind lady. Like, instead, she's like teasing her and doing, you know, sort of mean stuff. And I think there's a certain point where Gloria kind of realizes she's gone too far. And that's kind of when she becomes more helpful. But
yeah, I think that the but it works so well, especially in terms of like the doll and where the doll went and all this, you know, sort of plot mechanics and whatever. But then it also pays off in like one of the best plot twists, the, you know, ring twice, if you know, watch out the window and see who goes into that phone booth to call.
That's such a great moment when she gets the calls.
Yeah.
Or when she gets the rings as soon as Mike's walking, like her reaction's so shocked, you know, it's really great.
Yeah, the second time that pays off, the one that she wasn't expecting basically to pay off is the winner. And like, I love that. I mean, it's such a fun, because you know that it should follow, you know, that this should happen or whatever. Maybe you aren't ready for it and you kind of go have that moment the same as her. But it's like such a it's such a good moment because it also is just like the thing that pushes her over.
Right.
Which I, again, gets into this whole concept of them essentially gaslighting Susie for the whole film.
Yes.
And setting up this whole weird idea that her husband might be set up for the murder of this woman who had been, whose body had been found, you know, earlier that day. I mean, same thing with Dal M for murder. Like, he loves essentially setting up that gaslighting just to end up having it blow up in their face.
Yeah, exactly. I think from the perspective of the criminals, they see her as sort of an easy target.
Yeah, definitely.
What's really great is how capable she ends up being. And like early on, she has that line with her husband.
Do I have to be the world's champion blind lady?
Yes.
You can see him encouraging her to be independent. And I like that, you know,
definitely,
actually.
Yeah.
It's, and of course, I mean, that's the thing that most films that have a blind hero have to do, where they take away the light so they have the advantage over their enemies, whether it's Zatoichi or Rutger Hauer or
Blind Fury
or any of that. Yeah.
I'm also thinking of Don't Breathe.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there the blind person ends up being more of a villain.
I love how it flips. It totally flips it.
You could have easily made a version of Don't Breathe where the blind guy turns out to be the like Charles Bronson kind of hero blowing away these punk kids, but he ends up being the actual villain of the film.
Yeah.
Sort of an obvious way to build tension is where, like, the dead body at the beginning, the audience can see something that she can't. So you're waiting for them to find it. It's like the Hitchcock saying about putting the bomb under the table, and you have to just wait and like, oh, is she going to find it? Is she going to reach out and touch? Or, you know, there's a lot of little moments like that where it's kind of, so, you know, some films, it can be kind of boring, but I like actually being a little bit one step ahead of her for a lot of it, because it gives you that extra tension and that extra suspense.
It's one of the elements in it that as soon as you're in that apartment, the first moment, it almost feels like everything in that apartment up until when she comes in is just primer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like setting the bomb, basically. You know the score and how they expect to play it. And then essentially the rest of it's just that loaded moment throughout and throughout. And then it keeps essentially stacking on top of itself until it finally ends up kind of surpassing itself when all of a sudden Rote takes out the two dudes, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then we realize that we've been left with like the sort of, you know, chaos agent,
right?
Versus like the, it's funny that they take the pains to set up the gentleman criminal or whatever, right? With like Tallman and the Sarge, and then we realize we've been left with like this, you know, this guy who just wants to be evil for evil's sake. Or the idea of, like, I mean, it's basically he's a sociopath.
Yes, exactly.
Before a lot of people were essentially, you know, talking a lot about sociopaths.
Well, even him talking about, oh, they had this, I think he says they had this comic book logic, or that, you know, they had comic book brains. And
right.
There's like a little bit of a Batman motif going on. Like, I noticed there's like two Batman references.
Oh, yeah.
No, Batman!
And just thinking how this was coming out at the same time as the Adam West Batman TV show, I've been watching it a lot lately, and it's this fun, very fun escapist place. And I think the fact that it sort of throws that in, and then you have Rote murder his accomplices and comes out as being like, oh, you know, I'm not a comic book villain is basically kind of what it says. It makes it feel more real, I guess, in a way. The fact that it kind of sets up a little bit of this like comic book villaininess with the costumes and the Batman references. And then, no, we're going to kill that and throw it out the window. And now this is real and this is dangerous.
Yeah. And it's totally, that's a really good point. I didn't even think of it that way, because that totally is like culturally where this movie is plopping in on. And it's interesting too that the three deaths that are in the film, or four, it's very not cool how they die.
Yeah.
How I mean that is like it's nasty. It's like very vicious the way they go. Even I mean,
run over by a car and stabbed.
Like the car scene in particular is like multiple times. I'm like running over it, and it shows it. And then the stabbing from behind is such a dastardly way to do it. So much so that it's like the same way that he introduces that weapon. It's like an echo of that seemingly innocuous thing that has a blade that pops out the bottom. And that's the same way that that weapon takes out a dude, you know what I mean? In this very underhanded way. It's so well done. And this is just getting back, I guess, to also trying to put a finger on what that unhinged element is in this film. It's the moment where you're like, this isn't safe. Like, we don't know how far this movie's going to go.
Right.
Because we thought we kind of knew where it was headed, and then it's kind of boiling over. And then once it's beyond, Rote gets whatever MacGuffin he gets, and then it's like, but I'm not done.
Yeah.
And this is Audrey Hepburn, man.
Yeah.
and this is what, like, what's this movie going to do to her?
I remember hearing that when they were making The Exorcist, they were trying to get Audrey Hepburn to star in it.
Oh my god.
And now I was sort of picturing that Audrey Hepburn from this in The Exorcist, what that would have been like her being terrorized and screaming, and
yeah,
I could actually see that working really well. Although, like, this is kind of right before she didn't exactly retire, but I think she sort of took a long hiatus, and then you have those couple late career films like Robin and Marian and Always, the Spielberg film. Like, she was more or less retired after this, I think. She didn't really act, and I don't know if you've ever seen it, but there's the letter she wrote Stanley Kubrick turning him down for Napoleon. He wanted her to play Josephine.
Oh, no.
But I think she was basically done with acting after this, which is sort of too bad because she was really great.
From what I had read, one of the reasons she'd picked it up was that she had wanted to play against type, just being in something different.
She was really versatile. You see all the filmmakers she worked with and what she was capable of doing. I think she was really, really good. I figure, like, this was produced by Mel Ferrer, who I think she was married to at that time, right?
Yeah, she was. The thing I'd read about it is that it was like a maybe this will save our marriage production, which it did not.
That's funny. That reminds me of The Others with Nicole Kidman, which I think was produced by Tom Cruise as sort of a let's save our marriage
films. That might be like a whole series of films. I can guarantee you there's more than just those two.
I don't know what it is about this kind of film that would appeal to that scenario, but that's funny.
Oh, the other thing that was funny that I picked up on was casting for the role for Alan Arkin, because I guess a lot of people weren't clamoring for the role of Rote, because Hepburn was like an early cast, and I guess there was a lot of consternation of people who didn't want to be the villain that was terrorizing.
Yeah, nobody Audrey wanted Hepburn to be the person going after Audrey Hepburn. I think this film has a really good IMDb trivia compared to a lot of other movies.
Dude,
I was going through the trivia section, and I think they mentioned they wanted George C. Scott for the Alan Arkin role, or they offered it to him. And it's sort of, I don't know, I was trying to picture that, and I think it would actually take away from some of the menace if he had like a more physically imposing guy.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way, yeah.
I think if it was a guy who looked like he could just overpower the two other accomplices, then maybe it wouldn't work as well. I don't know.
Not at all. I think a lot of the recipe that makes him so unnerving is the fact that he's slight, seemingly. But he's still like got some strength. But I mean, he seems slight. And then he's also very smart, obviously. And then also very charming in a very sickly sort of way.
Yeah.
And then also that he's just obviously morally unloosed. Like, he doesn't have anything anchoring him to stop him. And it's like, it's all that stuff. And it just plays against the rest of his roles and most of his career that it's just like so wonderful to see him in this.
Yeah.
Like, if anybody's listening that hasn't seen Wait Until Dark, I'm like, obviously a lot of spoilers just happened.
But like, if you made it like, this far.
Do yourself a favor. I mean, like, listen, you could know every part of this movie and still go in it and for the first time to watch it. And it's just a treat because of how well it's pulled off.
Absolutely. I read, too, there was a revival of the stage play in 1998.
I saw, yeah.
Well, do you want to say who was cast in it?
No, go ahead.
Okay, well, it was Marissa Tomei as the lead and Tarantino, Quentin Tarantino, yeah. In the Alan Arkin role. And I haven't, obviously I haven't seen this. I don't know even if there's like a recorded copy available, but apparently he wasn't received very well.
Yeah, I mean, to be frank, like, his acting's whatever.
Yeah.
But of course he wanted to be Rote, because Rote's like I said, he's like this enigmatic villain. It totally makes sense that Tarantino would want to be Rote. And it also makes sense that maybe he wasn't that good at it.
I could picture him sort of hamming it up a little bit and just, like, yeah. Spitting out that dialogue. I could sort of picture that when I read that. I'm not sure today who you would want to cast as Rote.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I feel like Rote is sort of cut from the same cloth as, like, the guys from Haneke's Funny Games.
Right.
Where it's, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. it's very much this... You know, it's like it's a sociopath, man. It's like very, very can be very charming, very unassuming, but then also very, you know, can easily just do whatever else that they need to or want to that they find amusing. I guess that's part of it too. Like, there's amusement in Rote.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, he's amused by this entire scenario.
Well, it's really fun when he comes in, like, his disguise, especially the second disguise where he's supposed to be like the son of his first disguise.
Yeah.
And, you know, he kind of pitches his voice up and he has that, like you said, it's a little bit like Funny Games at the beginning when they're ingratiating themselves and kind of trying to get into this home. And
yeah.
That's part of what makes it fun, but also unsettling. So it works really well.
Oh, it's so good. And it's also, I mean, even when he's getting like, what is that, developer or something that she splashes in his face, basically?
Yeah.
All that stuff. Like, there's no point where he's like freaked out.
No.
Except for, like, maybe when he might be set on fire or something like that. And well, even
it's such
then,
a good moment,
like,
when she's like, can you see me? And just as he responds, she hears where he is and she throws it at him.
Yeah.
That whole sequence is great. He even gets his slasher horror movie moment where after she stabs him, he's crawling like the Terminator or something towards
well,
her.
Well, even before that, like, to me, the most iconic thing about this film, it's like an eighth of a second. And it's when he does this lurch through the air after her in the light of the fridge. I was actually talking with my aunt about this film and mentioned that we were going to speak about it. And she was like, I saw that movie when it came out in 67. And the entire theater went bananas when he jumped after her.
Oh.
Because everybody just shouted. Like, everybody was just terrified of this moment. I mean, it's like an all-timer for me, this moment. Everything working in concert of just the moment, this crazy tense scene, the actual physicality of it, the music, because it has this awesome, like, Mancini's sting of, like, you know, fingers across the piano strings or
yes.
Something crazy. Like, it's so good. Like, it makes me... I literally want to watch it right now again because it's, like, so wonderful. And it's like, if you can get that out of an audio, like, if you can pull that together just once, it's so hard to make a movie, period.
I really wish I could see this with an audience. I mean,
yeah.
I was reading also that when it was in theaters, when it first came out, some theaters would slowly dim the lights and then turn off the lights during the climax.
Oh,
which,
yeah.
It's not quite like a William Castle kind of a gimmick, but just to see it that way would be so cool.
Oh my God, yeah. And I mean, it's because it's black.
Yeah.
It's not like film black, like it's black. When it goes out and when it comes back on, it's so effective.
I really love that feeling, like when you're with an audience and you can just feel the tension and when somebody sees something. And I remember, what was it, Hereditary, when that came out, there's
oh,
like a scene
yes.
towards the end where it's very dark, but you see, I guess I should spoil it, but there's, you see something in like a top corner of the frame and like you could just feel like which parts of the audience saw that and you could just feel vibes going through, you know. And I think it might be that kind of film where if you saw it with an audience, you could just feel other people's reactions and how they're responding, even if they're not making noise. You know, sometimes you just pick up on those vibes and it's really great.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's one of the biggest things that I miss right now with not being able to go see movies. It's made me really nostalgic. It's funny, too. I mean, it's obviously a lot of people enjoy watching movies at home. I mean, I enjoy it to a certain extent. But, like, you can watch the same movie that you've seen a dozen times at home for the first time on the big screen, even if it's old and you find a revival or whatever. And it just plays different.
Yeah.
I think there's something about it being overpowering just as an image. And then also that you can't turn off or pause or whatever. That's like necessary to a certain degree. That's an element to movies.
I always say some movies you kind of need to see in the theater because you're trapped in a good way. Like, I always think some films, it doesn't have that same sort of power when you know that you could just pause it and go. And, you know, the fact that you're there and you're kind of, you could technically leave if you really want to, if you're really scared, but you know you're going to miss it if you leave. It's happening before your eyes and you have no control over that. It's kind of a nice feeling, actually, in a strange way.
For me, it heightens the emotional element to it to a certain degree when it's working.
Yeah.
And I'm always going to want to see it in the theater.
Yeah.
If you can. Like 100%. Did you see the bit of trivia about the first time that Hepburn met the director, Terrence Young? He was, get this, she was 16, volunteering in a Dutch hospital during World War II, helping nurse wounded soldiers. And he was like this young British paratrooper that had been wounded, and she straight up was nursing him. And then 20 years later, they made this movie. Isn't that crazy? 20 some odd years
I love
later.
Coincidences like that. That's really great.
Awesome.
I did see another actor that got mentioned for the Alan Arkin part was Sean Connery. And of course,
Terrence
Young, he had done the James Bond movies.
Yeah.
So you almost had Hepburn and Sean Connery together before Robin and Marion. But,
no, I don't think that would have worked.
I don't think that would have worked.
It's honestly like an all-timer for me. Like Alan Arkin is like an all-timer.
Yeah.
And it hardly ever gets talked about. Or maybe everybody just sort of knows this and I didn't realize that. Everybody...
No, I think you're right.
One of the reasons why I really wanted to talk about this film is like there's a couple of films that are near and dear to me for various reasons. And this is definitely one of them that just never gets talked about. And it's, you know, I mean, it's funny too, because it's like, it's also dated in a certain sense. You know, Susie's character given independence, or basically making a big point of like, she's obviously capable of taking all these dudes to task. But it's still like, you know, I wish I could see so I could like pick out wallpaper or like, you know, like help them choose a tie like that, to wear. Yeah. And you're like, oh, but it's, you know, aside from those trappings, though, it really is like an incredible movie.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, Dial M for Murder, I really love. For whatever reason, they always play it in theaters around my birthday in 3D.
Oh, cool.
So I always have fun going to see that. But just watching this now, like I think this might actually be better than Dial M for Murder. So I'm like, it's kind of has everything I like about that film, but it's like just a little bit edgier. And I don't know, I'm really, really blown away by it.
Yeah, I mean, I will say this, like Hitchcock deals with objects a little better than Terrence Young. But
I love
the giant
telephone in Dial M for Murder.
Yeah,
it's
such
a great idea, like to get that close up.
Like Hitchcock can shoot a key like nobody's business. But but I mean, it does have that edge for me because it's got an element to it that Dial M for Murder doesn't have, you know, like, and like we've been talking about this whole time. Like it's just got this thing to it. It's intangible in a cool way, but it's also like kind of unnerving in a really cool way.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's perfectly put. I was wondering, have you seen the Terrence Young film Inch On about the Korean War?
No, I have not.
I don't know. I'm just bringing this up, not because it's relevant at all, but because I needed an excuse to mention it. But it's like one of the strangest productions I've ever found out about. And the film itself is kind of boring, but I desperately want some kind of behind the scenes story about this because it's got Sir Laurence Olivier and Toshiro Mifune and like a really great cast, but it was funded by the the Mooney Church, the Korean cult. Oh. And it's like this really bizarre thing where, you know, they talked about, like, they had I think it's the only film that has consulting by the ghost of General Douglas MacArthur, because they had like a medium on set to supposedly have the ghost of Douglas MacArthur tell them what to do. Like, everything about this movie sounds completely insane and bizarre, and it's just, it's not up on screen, but I always was really fascinated by that. And that's also Terrence Young. That's one of his later films.
Yeah, so. Late period Young. And it was like, and it looks like it was 81, which is like, I mean, I feel like those were like no holds barred times for filmmaking, it feels like.
Anyway, I just needed to say that somewhere.
I'm glad you did, because this is completely just like jumped up on my, I mean, I might check it out. It didn't sound like the movie might be that great, but it sounds like the story of the movie is amazing.
Yeah, if somebody ever did like a book about it or something like that, I would pick that up immediately. Or that's the kind of film where if somebody said, well, you know, they're putting it out on Blu-ray with like a million special features, I would buy that just to see what people have to say about it. Terrence Young made multiple films with Toshiro Mifune. He also did Red Sun, so that's a strange collaboration.
Yeah. I'm curious. I mean, there's obviously got to be there's still people that were involved in the production that could do an oral history of this thing.
And some films like that I get fixated on, and I have to find out everything I can about it, even if the film's not great. Thank you, Patrick, for coming on to talk about the film. I had a really great time. And I was wondering if folks want to find you online, if there's anywhere you want to direct them to, or if there's anything you'd like to plug.
Sure, yeah. Well, it's been my pleasure, and thanks again for having me on. And you can find me, I usually post like a drawing a day up on my Twitter, which you can just find me at my name, at Patrick Horvath. Or also you can find me on Instagram at Catbird Planet. And it's, for whatever reason, I just end up starting the day with a drawing just to clear my head.
I really like your drawings and your paintings and everything you post. And I know you also have a Patreon that...
Yes, I do.
I'm on. Yes, I don't always comment because I get the pictures right in my emails, so I just look at them there, but I always enjoy seeing them.
Oh, yeah. Man, thank you so much for that. I appreciate that. If anybody is interested, I also do my Patreon, where I post up extra drawing stuff, things I'm working on, music playlists.
Cool. And if folks want to follow this show, of course, it's flixoist.com. I'm at Movie Kessler on Twitter. And I know, until next time, listeners, don't turn off the lights. Or maybe do turn off the lights if you want to get an upper hand on some criminals. I don't know. But take care.